And through the lightning-rent flesh, he thought he glimpsed the shining mystery beyond.
Clint dreaded the rainy season in Southern California. Most of the year was dry, and in the on-again, off-again drought of the past decade, some winters were marked by only a few storms. When the rain finally fell, the natives seemed to have forgotten how to drive in it. As gutters overflowed, the streets clogged with traffic. The freeways were worse. They looked like infinitely long car washes in which the conveyors had broken down. While the gray light slowly faded out of that Monday afternoon, he drove first to Palomar Laboratories in Costa Mesa. It was a large, single-story concrete block building, one block west of Bristol Avenue. Their medical lab division analyzed blood samples, pap smears, and biopsies, among other things, but they also performed industrial and geological sample analyses of all kinds. He parked his Chevy in the adjoining lot. Carrying a plastic bag from Vaughn's supermarket, he sloshed through the deep puddles, head bent against the driving rain, and went into a small reception lounge, dripping copiously. An attractive young blonde sat on a stool behind the counter at the reception window. She was wearing a white uniform and a purple cardigan. She said, "You should have an umbrella." Clint nodded, put the supermarket bag on the counter, and began to untie the knot in the straps to open it. "At least a raincoat," she said. From an inside jacket pocket, he withdrew a Dakota and Dakota card, passed it to her. "Is this who you want to build?" she asked. "Yeah." "Have you used our service before?" "Yeah." "You have an account?" "Yeah." "I haven't seen you in here before." "No." "My name's Lisa. I've only been here about a week. Never had a private eye come in before. At least, since I've started." From the large white sack, he withdrew three smaller clear Ziploc bags and lined them up side by side. "You got a name?" she asked, cocking her head, smiling at him. "Clint." "You go around without an umbrella or a raincoat in this weather, Clint, you'll catch your death, even as sturdy as you look." "First the shirt," Clint said, pushing the bag forward. "We want the bloodstains analyzed, not just typed. We want the whole nine yards, a complete genetic workup, too. Take samples from four different parts of the shirt, because there might be more than one person's blood on it. If so, do a workup on both." Lisa frowned at Clint, then at the shirt in the bag. She began filling out the analysis order. "Same program on this one," he said, pushing forward the second bag. It contained a folded sheet of Dakota and Dakota stationery that was mottled with several spots of blood. Back at the office, Julie had sterilized a pin in a match flame, stuck Frank Pollard's thumb, and squeezed the crimson samples onto the paper. "We want to know if any of the blood on the shirt matches what's on the stationery." The third bag contained the black sand. "Is this a biological substance?" Lisa asked. "I don't know. It looks like sand." "Well, because if it's a biological substance, it should go to our medical division. But if it's not biological, it should go to the industrial lab. Send a little to both and put a rush on it. Costs more, whatever." As she filled out the third form, she said, "There's a few beaches in Hawaii with black sand. You ever been there?"
"No."
"Kaimu. That's the name of one of the black beaches. Comes from a volcano somehow. The sand, I mean. You like beaches?"
"Yeah."
She looked up, her pen poised over the form, and gave him a big smile. Her lips were full, her teeth were very white. "I love the beach. Nothing I like better than putting on a bikini and soaking up some sun. Really, just baking in the sun. And I don't care what they say about a tan being bad for you. Life's short anyway, you know. Might as well look good while we're here. Besides, being in the sun makes me feel, not lazy exactly, because I don't mean it saps my energy, just the opposite. It makes me feel full of energy, but a lazy energy, sort of the way a lioness walks, you know? Strong-looking but easy. The sun makes me feel like a lioness." He said nothing. She said, "It's erotic, the sun. I guess that's what I'm trying to say. You lay out in the sun enough on a nice beach, and all your inhibitions sort of melt away." He just stared at her. After she finished filling out the analysis orders, gave him copies, and attached each order to the correct sample, Lisa said, Listen, Clint, we're living in a modern world, right? He didn't know what she meant. She said, we're all liberated these days, am I right? So if a girl finds a guy attractive, she doesn't have to wait for him to make the move. Oh, Clint thought. Leaning back on her stool, maybe to let him see how her full breasts filled out her white uniform blouse, she smiled and said, would you be interested in a dinner? Movie? No. Her smile froze. Sorry, he said. He folded the copies of the work order and put them in the same jacket pocket from which he earlier had withdrawn a business card. She was glaring at him, and he realized he'd hurt her feelings. Searching for something to say, all he could come up with was, I'm gay. She blinked and shook her head as if recovering from a stunning blow. Like sun-piercing clouds, her smile broke through the gloom on her face. Ooh, had to be to resist this package, I guess. Sorry. Hey, it's not your fault. We are what we are, huh? He went into the rain again. It was getting colder. The sky looked like the ruins of a burnt-out building to which the fire department had arrived too late. Wet ashes, dripping cinders. As night fell on that rainy Monday, Bobby Dakota stood at the hospital window and said, well, not much of a view, Frank, unless you're keen on parking lots. He turned and surveyed the small, white room. Hospitals always gave him the creeps, but he did not express his true feelings to Frank. The decor sure won't be featured in Architectural Digest anytime soon, but it's comfy enough. You've got TV, magazines, and three meals a day in bed. I notice some of the nurses are real lookers, too, but please, try to keep your hands off the nuns, okay? Frank was paler than ever. The dark circles around his eyes had grown like spreading ink blots. He not only looked as if he belonged in a hospital, but as if he'd been there for weeks already. He used the power controls to tilt the bed up. Are these tests really necessary? Your amnesia might have a physical cause, Julie said. You heard Dr. Freeborn. They'll look for cerebral abscesses, neoplasm cysts, clots, all kinds of things. I'm not sure about this Freeborn, Frank said worriedly. Sanford Freeborn was Bobby and Julie's friend as well as their physician. A few years ago, they had helped him get his brother out of deep trouble. Why? What's wrong with Sandy? Frank said, I don't know him. You don't know anybody, Bobby said. That's your problem, remember? You're an amnesiac. After accepting Frank as a client, they had taken him directly to Sandy Freeborn's office for a preliminary examination. All Sandy knew was that Frank could remember nothing but his name. They had not told him about the bags of money, the blood, black sand, red gems, weird insect, or any of the rest of it. Sandy didn't ask why Frank had come to them instead of the police, or why they'd accepted a case so far outside their usual purview. One of the things that made him a good friend was his reliable discretion. Nervously adjusting the sheets, Frank said, "You think a private room is really necessary?" Julie nodded. "You also want us to find out what you do at night, where you go, which means monitoring you, tight security." "A private room's expensive," Frank said. "You can afford the finest care," Bobby said. "Well, the money in those bags might not be mine," Bobby shrugged. "Well, then you'll have to work off your hospital bill, change a few hundred beds, empty a few thousand bedpans, perform some brain surgery free of charge. You might be a brain surgeon, who knows? With amnesia, it's just as likely you've forgotten that you're a surgeon as that you're a used car salesman. Worth a try. Get a bone saw. Cut off the top of some guy's head. Have a peek in. See if anything looks familiar." Leaning against the bed rail, Julie said, "When you're not in radiology or some other department undergoing tests, we'll have a man with you watching over you. Tonight, it's Hal." Hal Yamataka had already taken his station in an uncomfortable-looking upholstered chair provided for visitors. He was to one side of the bed between Frank and the door, in a position to watch both his charge and, if Frank was in the mood, the wall-mounted television. Hal resembled a Japanese version of Clint Karagiosis, about 5'7" or 5'8", broad in the shoulders and chest, as solid-looking as if he had been built by a mason who knew how to fit stones tight together and hide the mortar. In case nothing worth watching was on television, and his charge proved to be a lousy conversationalist, he had brought a John D. MacDonald novel. Looking at the rain-washed window, Frank said, I guess I'm just scared. No need to be scared, Bobby said. Hal's not as dangerous as he looks. He's never killed anyone he liked. Only once, Hal said. Bobby said, you once killed someone you liked? Over what? He asked to borrow my comb. Well, there you go, Frank, Bobby said. Just don't ask to borrow his comb and you're safe. Frank was in no mood to be kidded. I can't stop thinking about waking up with blood on my hands. I'm afraid maybe I've already hurt someone. I don't want to hurt anyone else. Oh, you can't hurt Hal, Bobby said. He's an impenetrable Oriental. Inscrutable, Hal said. I'm an inscrutable Oriental. I don't want to hear about your sex problems, Hal. Anyway, if you didn't eat so much sushi and didn't have raw fish breath, you'd get scruted as often as anyone. Reaching over the bed railing, Julie took one of Frank's hands. He smiled weakly. Your husband always like this, Mrs. Dakota? Call me Julie. Do you mean, does he always act like a wise ass or a child? Not always, but most of the time, I'm afraid. You hear that, Hal, Bobby said. Women and amnesiacs, they have no sense of humor. To Frank, Julie said, my husband believes everything in life should be fun, even car accidents, even funerals, even dental hygiene, Bobby said. And he'd probably be making jokes about fallout in the middle of a nuclear war. It's just the way he is. He can't be cured. She's tried, Bobby said. She sent me to a happiness detox center. They promised to knock some gloom into me. Couldn't. You'll be safe here, Julie said, squeezing Frank's hand before letting go of it. Hal will look after you.
The entomologist's house was in the Turtle Rock development in Irvine, within easy driving distance of the university. Low, black, mushroom-shaped Malibu lamps threw circles of light on the rain-puddled walkway that led to the softly gleaming oak doors. Carrying one of Frank Pollard's leather flight bags, Clint stepped onto the small covered porch and rang the bell. A man spoke to him through an intercom set just below the bell push. Who is it, please? Dr. Dyson Manfred? I'm Clint Karagiosis from Dakota and Dakota. Half a minute later, Manfred opened the door. He was at least 10 inches taller than Clint, 6'5" or 6", and thin. He was wearing black slacks, a white shirt, and a green necktie. The top button of the shirt was undone, and the tie hung loose. Good God, man, you're soaked. Just damp. Manfred moved back, opening the door wide, and Clint stepped into the tile-floored foyer. As he closed the door, Manfred said, ought to have a raincoat or umbrella on a night like this. It's invigorating. What is? Bad weather, Clint said. Manfred looked at him as if he was strange, but in Clint's view, it was Manfred himself who was strange. The guy was too thin, all bones. He could not fill his clothes. His trousers hung shapelessly on his knobby hips, and his shoulders poked at the fabric of his shirt as if only bare, sharp bones lay under there. Angular and graceless, he looked as if he had been assembled from a pile of dry sticks by an apprentice god. His face was long and narrow, with a high brow and a lantern jaw, and his well-tanned, leathery skin seemed to be stretched so tight over his cheekbones that it might split. He had peculiar amber eyes that regarded Clint with an expression of cool curiosity, no doubt familiar to the thousands of bugs he had pinned to specimen boards. Manfred's gaze traveled down Clint to the floor, where water was puddling around his running shoes. Sorry, Clint said. It'll dry. I was in my study. Come along. Glancing into the living room to his right, Clint noted fleur-de-lis wallpaper, a thick Chinese rug, too many overstuffed chairs and sofas, antique English furniture, wine-red velour drapes, and tables cluttered with bibelots that glimmered in the lamplight. It was a very Victorian room, not in harmony with the California lines and layout of the house itself. He followed the entomologist past the living room, along a short hall, to the study. Manfred had a singular, stilting gait, Tall and stick-like as he was, with shoulders hunched and head thrust forward slightly, he seemed as unevolved and prehistoric as a praying mantis. Clint had expected a university professor's study to be crammed full of books, but only 40 or 50 volumes were shelved in one case to the left of the desk. There were cabinets with wide, shallow drawers that probably were filled with creepy crawlies, and on the walls were insects in specimen boxes framed under glass. When he saw Clint staring at one collection in particular, Manfred said, "Cockroaches, beautiful creatures." Clint did not reply. "The simplicity of their design and function, I mean, few would find them beautiful in appearance, of course." Clint couldn't shake the feeling that the bugs were really alive. Manfred said, "What do you think of that big fellow in the corner of the collection?" "Well, he's big, sir. Madagascar hissing roach. The scientific name's Gramfordarina portentosa. That one's over 8.5 centimeters long, about 3.5 inches. Absolutely beautiful, isn't he?" Clint said nothing. Settling into the chair behind his desk, Manfred somehow folded his long, bony arms and legs into that compact space, the way a large spider could scrunch itself into a tiny ball. Clint did not sit down. Having put in a long day, he was eager to go home. Manfred said, "I received a call from the university chancellor. He asked me to cooperate with your Mr. Dakota in any way I could." UCI, the University of California at Irvine, had long been striving to become one of the country's premier universities. The current chancellor, and the one before him, had sought to attain that status by offering enormous salaries and generous fringe benefits to world-class professors and researchers at other institutions. Before committing substantial resources in the form of a well-upholstered job offer, however, the university hired Dakota and Dakota to conduct a background investigation on the prospective faculty member. Even a brilliant physicist or biologist could have too great a thirst for whiskey, a nose for cocaine, or an unfortunate attraction to underage girls. UCI wanted to buy brain power, respectability, and academic glory, not scandal. Dakota and Dakota served them well. Manfred propped his elbows on the arms of his chair and steepled his fingers, which were so long that they looked as if they must have at least one extra knuckle each. "What's the problem?" he asked. Clint opened a leather flight bag and removed the quart-size wide-mouth mason jar. He put it on the entomologist's desk. The bug in the jar was at least twice as big as the Madagascar hissing roach on the wall. For a moment, Dr. Dyson Manfred seemed to have been quick-frozen. He didn't move a finger. His eyes didn't blink. He stared intently at the creature in the jar. At last, he said, "What is this? A hoax?" "It's real." Manfred leaned forward, hunching over the desk and lowering his head until his nose almost touched the thick glass behind which the insect crouched.
"Alive?"
"Dead."
"Where did you find this? Not here in Southern California?"
"Yes."
"Impossible!"
"What is it?" Clint asked. Manfred looked up at him, scowling.
"I've never seen anything like it. And if I haven't seen anything like it, neither has anyone else. It's of the phylum Arthropoda, I'm sure, which includes such things as spiders and scorpions, but whether it can be classed as an insect, I can't say, not until I've examined it. If it is an insect, it's of a new species. Where exactly did you find it? And why on earth would it be of interest to private detectives?"
"I'm sorry, sir, but I can't tell you anything about the case. I have to protect the client's privacy." Manfred carefully turned the jar around in his hand, studying the resident from every side.
"Just incredible!" I must have it.
He looked up, and his amber eyes were no longer cool and appraising, but gleaming with excitement.
I must have this specimen.
Well, I intended to leave it with you for examination, Clint said. But as to whether you can have permanent possession...
Yes, permanent.
That's up to my boss and the client. Meanwhile, we want to know what it is, where it comes from, everything you can tell us about it. With exaggerated care, as if handling the finest crystal instead of ordinary glass, Manfred put the jar on the blotter.
I'll make a complete photographic and videotape record of the specimen, from every angle and in extreme close-up. Then it'll be necessary to dissect it, though that'll be done with utmost care, I assure you.
Whatever.
Mr. Karagiosis, you seem terribly blasé about this. Do you fully understand what I've said? This would appear to be an entirely new species, which would be extraordinary. Because how could any such species producing individuals of this size be overlooked for so long? This is going to be big news in the world of entomology, Mr. Karagiosis. Very big news.
Clint looked at the bug in the bottle. He said, Yeah, I figured.
From the hospital, Bobby and Julie drove a company Toyota into the county's western flatlands to Garden Grove, looking for 884 Serape Way, the address on the driver's license that Frank held in the name of George Ferris. Julie peered through the rain-dappled side windows and forward between the thumping windshield wipers checking house numbers. The street was lined with bright sodium vapor lamps and 30-year-old single-story homes. They had been built in two basic boxy models, but an illusion of individuality was provided by a variety of trim. This one was stucco with brick accents. This one was stucco with cedar shingle panels, or Bokeh Canyon stone, or desert bark, or volcanic rock. California was not all Beverly Hills, Bel Air, and Newport Beach, not all mansions and seaside villas, which was the television image. Economies of home design had made the California dream accessible to the waves of immigrants that for decades had flooded in from back east, and now from farther shores, as was evident from Vietnamese and Korean language bumper stickers on some cars parked along Serape. Next block, Julie said, my side. Some people said such neighborhoods were a blot on the land, but to Bobby, they were the essence of democracy. He had been raised on a street like Serape Way, north in Anaheim instead of Garden Grove, and it had never seemed ugly. He remembered playing with other kids on long summer evenings when the sun set with orange and crimson flares and the feathery silhouettes of the backlit palms were as black as ink drawings against the sky. At twilight, the air sometimes smelled of star jasmine and echoed with the cry of a lingering seagull far to the west. He remembered what it meant to be a kid with a bicycle in California, the vistas for exploration, the grand possibilities for adventure. Every street of stucco homes, seen for the first time and from the seat of a Schwinn, had seemed exotic. Two coral trees dominated the yard at 884 Serape. The white blooms of the azalea bushes were softly radiant in the bleak night. Tinted by the sodium vapor street lamps, the falling rain looked like molten gold. But as Bobby hurried along the walkway behind Julie, the rain was almost as cold as sleet on his face and hands. He was wearing a warmly lined nylon jacket with a hood, but he shivered. Julie rang the doorbell. The porch light came on, and Bobby sensed someone looking them over through the fisheye lens in the front door. He pushed back his hood and smiled. The door opened on a security chain, and an Asian man peered out. He was in his 40s, short, slender, with black hair, fading to gray at the temples. Yes? Julie showed him her private investigator's license and explained that they were looking for someone named George Ferris. Police? The man frowned. Nothing wrong. No need for police. No, see, we're private investigators, Bobby explained. The man's eyes narrowed. He looked as if he would close the door in their faces, but abruptly he brightened, smiled. Oh, you're PI, like on TV. He took the chain off the door and let them in. Actually, he didn't just let them in, he welcomed them, as if they were honored guests. Within 3 minutes flat, they learned his name was Tuong Tran Phan, the order of his names having been rearranged to accommodate the Western custom of putting the surname last. And he and his wife Chin were among the boat people who fled Vietnam 2 years after the fall of Saigon. That they had worked in laundries and dry cleaners, and eventually opened 2 dry cleaning stores of their own. Tuong insisted on taking their coats. Chin, a petite woman with delicate features, dressed in baggy black slacks and a yellow silk blouse, said she would provide refreshments, even though Bobby explained that only a few minutes of their time was required. Bobby knew first-generation Vietnamese Americans were sometimes suspicious of policemen, even to the extent of being reluctant to call for help when they were victims of crime. The South Vietnamese police often had been corrupt, and the North Vietnamese overlords who seized the South after the U.S. withdrawal had been murderous. Even after 15 years or longer in the States, many Vietnamese remained at least somewhat distrustful of all authorities. In the case of Tuong and Chin Phan, however, that suspicion did not extend to private investigators. Evidently, they had seen so many heroic television gumshoes, they believed all PIs were champions of the underdog, knights with blazing 38s instead of lances. In their role as liberators of the oppressed, Bobby and Julie were conducted, with some ceremony, to the sofa, which was the newest and best piece of furniture in the living room. The Fonz marshaled their exceptionally good-looking children in the living room for introductions. 13-year-old Rocky, 10-year-old Sylvester, 12-year-old Sissy, and 6-year-old Merrill. They were obviously born and raised Americans, except that they were refreshingly more courteous and well-mannered than many of their contemporaries. When introductions had been made, the kids returned to the kitchen, where they had been doing their schoolwork. In spite of their polite protestations, Bobby and Julie were served coffee laced with condensed milk and exquisite little Vietnamese pastries. The Fonz had coffee as well. Tuan and Chin sat in worn armchairs that were visibly less comfortable than the sofa. Most of the furniture was in simple contemporary styles and neutral shades. A small Buddhist shrine stood in one corner. Fresh fruit lay on the red altar, and several sticks of incense bristled from ceramic holders. Only one stick was lit, and a pale blue ribbon of fragrant smoke curled upward. The only other Asian elements were black lacquered tables. "We're looking for a man who might once have lived at this address," Julie said, selecting one of the petit fours from the tray on which Mrs. Phan had served them. "His name's George Ferris." "Yes, he lived here," Tuong said, and his wife nodded. Bobby was surprised. He'd been certain that the Ferris name and address had been randomly matched by a document forger, that Frank had never lived here. Frank had been equally certain that Pollard, not Ferris, was his real name. "You bought this house from George Ferris?" Julie asked. Tuong said, "No, he was dead." "Dead?" Bobby asked. 5 or 6 years ago," Tuong said. "Terrible cancer." "Then, Frank Pollard wasn't Ferris, and hadn't lived here. The ID was entirely fake." "We bought house just a few months ago from widow," Tuong said. His English was good, though occasionally he dropped the article before the noun. "No, what I mean to say, from widow's estate." Julie said, "So Mrs. Ferris is dead too?" Tuong turned to his wife, and a meaningful look passed between them. He said, "It is very sad. Where do such men come from?" Julie said, "What man are you speaking of, Mr. Phan?" "The one who killed Mrs. Ferris, her brother, 2 daughters." Something seemed to slither and coil in Bobby's stomach. He instinctively liked Frank Pollard and was certain of his innocence, but suddenly a worm of doubt bored into the fine, polished apple of his conviction. Could it be just a coincidence that Frank was carrying the ID of a man whose family had been slaughtered? Or was Frank responsible? He was chewing a bite of cream-filled pastry, and though it was tasty, he had trouble swallowing it. "It was late July," Chin said, "during the heat wave, which you may remember." She blew on her coffee to cool it. Bobby noticed that most of the time Chin spoke perfect English, and he suspected that her occasional infelicities of language were conscious mistakes that she inserted in order not to seem more well-spoken than her husband, a subtle and thoroughly Asian courtesy. "We buy house last October." "They never catch the killer," Tuang Fan said. "Do they have a description of him?" Julie asked. "I don't think so." Reluctantly, Bobby glanced at Julie. She appeared to be as shaken as he was, but she did not give him an I-told-you-so look. She said, "How were they murdered? Shot? Strangled? Knife, I think. Come, I show you where bodies were found." The house had 3 bedrooms and 2 bathrooms, but 1 bath was being remodeled. The tile had been torn off the walls, floor, and counter. The cabinets were being rebuilt with quality oak. Julie followed Tuang into the bathroom, and Bobby stayed at the doorway with Mrs. Fan. The rattle hiss of the rain echoed down through the ceiling vent. Tuang said, "Body of youngest Ferris' daughter was here on the floor. She was 13. Terrible thing. Much blood. The grout between tiles was permanently stained. All had to come out." He led them into the bedroom his daughters shared, 2 beds, nightstands, and 2 small desks left little room for anything else, but Sissy and Merrill had squeezed in a lot of books. Tuang Fan said, "Mrs. Ferris's brother, staying with her for a week, was killed here, in his bed. Blood was on walls, carpet. We saw the house before it was listed with a real estate agent, before the carpet was replaced and the walls repainted," Chin Fan said. "This room was the worst. It gave me bad dreams for a while." They proceeded to a sparsely furnished master bedroom, a queen-sized bed, nightstands, 2 ginger jar lamps, but no bureau or chest of drawers. The clothes that would not fit in the closet were arranged along 1 wall, in cardboard storage boxes with clear plastic lids. Their frugality struck Bobby as similar to his and Julie's. Perhaps they, too, had a dream for which they were working and saving. Tuang said, "Mrs. Ferris was found in this room in her bed. Terrible things were done to her. She was bitten, but they never wrote about that in newspapers." "Bitten?" Julie said. "By what?" "Probably by killer. On the face, throat, other places." "If they didn't write about it in the papers," Bobby said, "how do you know about the bites? Neighbor who found bodies still lives next door. She says that both older daughter and Mrs. Ferris were bitten." Mrs. Fan said, "She's not the kind to imagine such things." "Where was the 2nd daughter found?" Julie asked. "Please follow me." Tuang led them back the way they had come, through the living room and dining room, into the kitchen. The 4 Fan children were sitting around a breakfast table. 3 of them were diligently reading textbooks and taking notes. No television or radio provided distraction, and they appeared to be enjoying their studies. Even Merrill, who was a 1st grader, and probably had no homework to speak of, was reading a children's book. Bobby noticed 2 colorful charts posted on the wall near the refrigerator. The first displayed each kid's grades and major test results since the start of the school year in September. The other was a list of household chores for which each child was responsible. Throughout the country, universities were in a bind, because an inordinately large percentage of the best applicants for admission were of Asian extraction. Blacks and Hispanics complained about being aced out by another minority, and whites shouted reverse racism when denied admission in favor of an Asian student. Some attributed Asian Americans' success to a conspiracy, but Bobby saw the simple explanation for their achievements everywhere in the Fan house. They tried harder. They embraced the ideals upon which the country had been based, including hard work, honesty, goal-oriented self-denial, and the freedom to be whatever one wanted to be. Ironically, their great success was partly due to the fact that so many born Americans had become cynical about those same ideals. The kitchen was open to a family room that was furnished as humbly as the rest of the house. Tuang said, "Oldest Ferris girl found here by sofa, 17. Very pretty girl," Chin said sadly. She, like Mother, was bitten, so our neighbors say. Julie said, what about the other victims, the younger daughter and Mrs. Ferris's brother? Were they bitten, too? Don't know, Tawn said. The neighbors didn't see their bodies, Chin said. They were silent for a moment, looking at the floor where the dead girl had been found, as if the enormity of this crime was such that the stain of it would somehow have reappeared on this brand new carpet. Rain droned on the roof. Bobby said, doesn't it sometimes bother you to live here? Not because murders took place in these rooms, but because the killer was never found. Don't you worry about him coming back some night? Chin nodded. Truong said, everywhere is danger. Life itself is danger. Less risky never being born. A faint smile flickered across his face and was gone. Leaving Vietnam in tiny boat was more danger than this. Glancing at the table in the adjoining kitchen, Bobby saw the four kids, still deeply involved with their studies. The prospect of a murderer returning to the scene of this crime did not faze them. In addition to dry cleaning, Chin said, we remodel houses, sell them. This is fourth. We will live here maybe another year, remodeling room by room, then sell. Take a profit. Truong said, because of murders, some people would not consider moving here after the Ferrises. But danger is also opportunity. When we finish the house, Chin said, it won't just be remodeled. It will be clean, spiritually clean. Do you understand? The innocence of the house will be restored. We will have chased out the evil that the killer brought here, and we'll have left our own spiritual imprint on these rooms. Nodding, Truong said, that is a satisfaction. Removing the forged driver's license from his pocket, Bobby held it so his fingers covered the name and address, leaving the photograph visible. Do you recognize this man? No, Truong said, and Chin agreed. As Bobby put the license away, Julie said, do you know what George Ferris looked like? No, Truong said. As I told you, he died of cancer many years before his family was killed. Well, I thought maybe you'd seen a photo of him here in the house before the Ferris's belongings were removed. No. Sorry. Bobby said, you mentioned earlier that you didn't buy the house through a realtor. You worked with the estate? Yes. Mrs. Ferris's other brother inherited everything. Do you happen to have his name and address? Bobby asked. I think we'll need to talk to him. Dinner time came. Derek woke up. He was groggy, but hungry, too. He leaned on Thomas when they walked to the dining room. Food got eaten. Spaghetti, meatballs, salad, good bread, chocolate cake, cold milk. Back in their room, they watched TV. Derek fell asleep again. It was a bad night on TV. Thomas sighed with disgust. After an hour or so, he stopped the set. None of the shows was smart enough to care about. They were too stupid silly, even for a moron, which Mary said he was. Maybe imbeciles would like them. Probably not. He used the bathroom, brushed his teeth, washed his face. He didn't look in the mirror. He didn't like mirrors because they showed him what he was. After changing into pajamas, he got in bed and made the lamp go dark, even though it was only 8:30. He turned on his side, with his head propped on two pillows, and studied the night sky, framed by the nearest window. No stars, clouds, rain. He liked rain. When a storm came down, it was like a lid on the night, and you didn't feel like you might float up in all that darkness and just disappear. He listened to the rain. It whispered. It cried tears on the window. Far away, the bad thing was loose. Ugly, nasty waves spread out from it, the way ripples spread across a pond when you dropped a stone in the water. The bad thing was like a big stone dropped into the night, a thing that didn't belong in this world, and with a little effort, Thomas could sense the waves from it breaking over him. He reached out, felt it, a throbbing thing, cold and full of anger. He wanted to get closer, learn what it was. He tried TVing a question at it. What are you? Where are you? What do you want? Why are you going to hurt Julie? Suddenly, like a big magnet, the bad thing began pulling him. He'd never felt anything like that before. When he tried to TV his thoughts to Bobby or Julie, they didn't grab him and pull at him the way this bad thing did. A part of his mind seemed to unravel like a ball of string, and the loose end sailed through the window and way up into the night, through the darkness, until it found the bad thing. Suddenly, Thomas was very close to the bad thing, too close. It was all around him, big, ugly, and so strange that Thomas felt like he'd dropped into a swimming pool full of ice and razor blades. He didn't know if it was a man, couldn't see its shape, only feel it. It might be pretty on the outside, but on the inside it was throbbing and dark and deep nasty. He sensed the bad thing was eating. The food was still alive and squirming. Thomas was scared big, and right away he tried to pull back, but for a moment the ugly mind held him tight, and he could get away only by picturing the mind string rewinding itself onto the ball. When the mind string was all wound up again, Thomas turned away from the window onto his stomach. He was breathing real fast. He listened to his heart boom. He had a sick-making taste in his mouth, the same taste he got sometimes when he bit his tongue not meaning to, and the same taste as when the dentist yanked one of his teeth meaning to. Blood. Sick and scared, he sat up in bed and made the lamp come on right away. He took a tissue from the box on the nightstand. He spit into it and looked to see if there was blood. There wasn't. Just spit. He tried again. No blood. He knew what that meant. He'd been too close to the bad thing, maybe even inside the bad thing, for just a blink. The ugly taste in his mouth was the same taste the bad thing tasted, tearing with its teeth into some living, squirming food. Thomas didn't have blood in his mouth. He just had a memory of blood in his mouth. But that was bad enough. This time, wasn't it all like biting his tongue or getting a tooth yanked, because this time what he tasted wasn't his own blood? Though enough warm was in the room, he started shivering and couldn't stop.
Candy prowled the canyons in the grip of urgent need, rattling wild animals out of burrows and nests. He was kneeling in the mud beside a huge oak, pummeled by rain, sucking blood from the ravished throat of a rabbit, when he felt someone place a hand atop his head. He threw down the rabbit and sprang to his feet, turning around as he did so. Nobody was there. Two of his sister's blackest cats were 20 feet behind him, visible only because their eyes were luminous in the gloom. They had been following him since he'd left the house. Otherwise, he was alone. For a second or two, he still felt the hand on his head, though no hand was there. Then the queer sensation passed. He studied the shadows on all sides and listened to the rain snapping through the oak leaves. Finally, shrugging off the episode, driven by his fierce need, he proceeded farther east, moving upslope. A 2-foot-wide stream had formed on the canyon floor, 6 or 8 inches deep, not large enough to hamper his progress. The drenched cats followed. He did not want them with him, but he knew from experience that he would not be able to chase them away. They did not always accompany him, but when they chose to follow in his tracks, they could not be dissuaded. After he had gone about 100 yards, he dropped to his knees again, held his hands in front of him, and allowed the power to erupt once more. Shimmering sapphire light swept through the night. Brush shook, trees stirred, and rocks clattered against one another. In the wake of the light, clouds of dust flew up, ghostly silver columns that rippled like wind-stirred shrouds, then vanished into the darkness. A bevy of animals burst from cover, and some raced toward Candy. He snatched at a rabbit, missed, but seized a squirrel. It tried to bite him, but he swung it hard by one leg, bashing its head against the muddy ground, stunning it. Violet was with Verbena in the kitchen. They were sitting on the layered blankets with 23 of their 25 cats. Parts of her mind and parts of her sister's were in Cinders and Lamia, the black cats through which they were accompanying their brother. Watching Candy seize and destroy his prey, Cinders and Lamia were excited, and Violet was excited too, electrified. The wet January night was deep, illumined only by the ambient light from the communities to the west, which was reflected off the bellies of the low clouds. In that wilderness, Candy was the wildest creature of them all, a fierce and powerful and merciless predator who crept swiftly and silently through the rugged canyons, taking what he needed and wanted. He was so strong and limber that he appeared to flow up the canyon, over rocks and fallen timber, around prickly brush, as if he were not a man of flesh and blood, but the rippled moon shadow of some flying creature soaring high above the earth. When Candy seized the squirrel and bashed its head against the ground, Violet divided the part of her mind that was in Lamy and Cinders, and also entered the squirrel. It was stunned by the blow. It struggled feebly and looked at Candy with unalloyed terror. Candy's big, strong hands were on the squirrel, but it seemed to Violet that they were on her as well, moving over her bare legs, hips, belly, and breasts. Candy snapped its spine against his bent knee. Violet shuddered. Verbena whimpered and clung to her sister. The squirrel no longer had any feeling in its extremities. With a low growl, Candy bit the animal's throat. He tore at its hide, chewing open the blood-rich vessels. Violet felt the hot blood spurting out of the squirrel, felt Candy's mouth fastened hungrily to the wound. It almost seemed as though no surrogate lay between them, as if his lips were pressed firmly to Violet's throat, and as if her own blood was flooding into his mouth. She wished that she could enter Candy's mind and be on both the giving and receiving end of the blood, but she could only meld with animals. She no longer had the strength to sit up. She settled back onto the blankets, only half aware that she was softly chanting a monotonous litany. Yes, 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 yes. Verbena rolled atop her sister. Around them, the cats tumbled together in a roiling mass of fur and tails and whiskered faces.
Thomas tried again, for Julie's sake. He reached out toward the cold, glowing mind of the bad thing. Right away, the bad thing drew him toward it. He let his mind unwind like a big ball of string. It pierced the window, zoomed into the night, made contact. He TV'd questions. What are you? Where are you? What do you want? Why are you going to hurt Julie?
Just as Candy threw aside the dead squirrel and got to his feet, he felt the hand on his head again. He twitched, turned, and flailed at the darkness with both fists. No one was behind him. With radiant amber eyes, the two cats watched him from about 20 feet away, dark blots on the pale silt. All the wildlife in the immediate vicinity had fled. If someone was spying on him, the intruder was concealed in the brush farther back along the canyon, or in a niche on one of the canyon walls, certainly not near enough to have touched him. Besides, he still felt the hand. He rubbed at the top of his head, half expecting to find leaves stuck in his wet hair. Nothing. But the pressure of a hand remained, even increased, and was so well-defined that he could feel the outlines of four fingers, a thumb, and the curve of a palm against his skull. What? Where? What? Why? Those words echoed inside his head. No voice had broken through the drizzling sounds of the rain. What? Where? What? Why? Kendi turned in a full circle, angry and confused. A crawling sensation arose in his head, different from anything he had ever known before, as if something was burrowing in his brain. Who are you? He said aloud. What? Where? What? Why? Who are you?
The bad thing was a man. Thomas knew that now. An ugly inside man. And something else, too. But still, at least partly a man. The bad thing's mind was like a whirlpool, blacker than black, swirling real fast, sucking Thomas down, down, wanting to gobble him alive. He tried to break loose, swim away. Wasn't easy. The bad thing was going to pull him into the bad place, and he'd never be able to come back. He thought he was a goner, but his fear of the bad place, of going where Julian Bobby would never find him, and where he'd be alone was so big, he finally tore free and rewound himself into his room at Cielo Vista. He slid down on the mattress and drew the covers over his head so he couldn't see the night beyond the window, and so nothing out there in the night could see him. Walter Havelow, Mrs. George Ferris's surviving brother and heir to her modest estate, lived in a richer neighborhood than the Fans, but he was poorer in courtesy and good manners. His English Tudor house in Villa Park had beveled glass windows filled with a light that Julie found warm and beckoning. But Havelow stood in the doorway and did not invite them inside, even after he had studied their PI license and returned it to her. What do you want? Havelow was tall, pot-bellied, with thinning blonde hair and a thick mustache that was part blonde and part red. His penetrating hazel eyes marked him as a man of intelligence, but they were cold, watchful, and calculating, the eyes of a mafia accountant. "As I explained," Julie said, "the Fonz told us that you could help. We need a photograph of your late brother-in-law, George Ferris." "Why?" "Well, as I said, there's a man going around pretending to be Mr. Ferris, and he's a player in a case we're working on. Can't be my brother-in-law, he's dead." "Yes, we know. But this imposter's ID is very good, and it would help us to have a photograph of the real George Ferris. I'm sorry, I can't tell you anything more. I'd be violating our client's privacy." Havelow turned away and closed the door in their faces. Bobby looked at Julie and said, "Mr. Conviviality." Julie rang the bell again. After a moment, Havelow opened the door. "What?" "Well, I know we arrived unannounced," Julie said, struggling to remain cordial, "and I apologize for the intrusion, but a photo of—" "I was just going to get the picture," he said impatiently. "I'd have had it in hand by now, if you hadn't rung the bell again." He turned away from them and closed the door a second time. "Is it our body odor?" Bobby wondered. "What a jerk. You think he's really coming back? He doesn't, and I'll break the door down." Behind them, rain dripped off the overhang that sheltered the last 10 feet of the walkway, and water gurgled hollowly through the downspout. Cold sounds. Havelow returned with a shoebox full of snapshots. "My time is valuable. If you want my cooperation, you'll keep that in mind." Julie resisted her worst instincts. Rudeness irritated the hell out of her. She fantasized knocking the box out of his grasp, seizing one of his hands, and bending the index finger as far back as it would go, thus straining the digital nerve on the front of his hand, while simultaneously pinching the radial and median nerves on the back, forcing him to kneel. Then a knee driven into the underside of his chin, a swift chop to the back of his neck, a well-placed kick to his soft, protruding belly. Havelow rummaged through the box and extracted a Polaroid of a man and a woman sitting at a redwood picnic table on a sunny day. "That's George and Irene." Even in the yellowish light of the porch lamp, Julie could see that George Ferris had been a rangy man with a long, narrow face, the exact physical opposite of Frank Pollard. Why would someone be claiming he's George? Havlow asked. We're dealing with a possible criminal who uses multiple fake IDs, Julie said. George Ferris is just one of his identities. No doubt your brother-in-law's name was probably chosen at random by the document forger this guy used. Forgers sometimes use the names and addresses of the deceased. Havlow frowned. You think it's possible this man using George's name is the same guy who killed Irene? My brother and my two nieces? No, Julie said immediately. We're not dealing with a killer here, just a confidence man, a swindler. Besides, Bobby said, no killer would link himself to murders he'd committed by getting ID in the name of his victim's husband. Making eye contact with Julie, clearly trying to determine how much they were snowing him, Havlow said, this guy your client? No, Julie lied. He ripped off our client, and we've been hired to track him down so he can be forced to make restitution. Bobby said, can we borrow this photo, sir? Havlow hesitated. He was still making eye contact with Julie. Bobby handed Havlow a Dakota and Dakota business card. We'll get the picture back to you. There's our address, phone number. I understand your reluctance to part with a family photo, especially since your sister and brother-in-law are no longer alive, but if... Apparently deciding that they were not lying, Havlow said, hell take it. I'm not sentimental about George. Never could stand him. Always thought my sister was a fool for marrying him. Thank you, Bobby said. We... Havlow stepped back and closed the door. Julie rang the bell. Bobby said, please, don't kill him. Scowling with impatience, Havlow opened the door. Stepping between Julie and Havlow, Bobby held out the forged driver's license bearing George Ferris's name and Frank's picture. One more thing, sir, and we'll get out of your hair. I live to a very tight schedule, Havlow said. Have you seen this man before? Irritated, Havlow took the driver's license and inspected it. Doughy face, bland features, there's a million like him within 100 miles of here, wouldn't you say? And you've never seen him? Are you slow-witted? Do I have to put it in short, simple sentences? No, I have never seen him. Retrieving the license, Bobby said, thanks for your time, and... Havlow closed the door. Hard. Julie reached for the bell. Bobby stayed her hand. We've got everything we came for. I know what you want, Bobby said, but torturing a man to death is against the law in California. He hustled her away from the house into the rain. In the car again, she said, that rude, self-important bastard. Bobby started the engine and switched on the windshield wipers. We'll stop at the mall, buy you one of those giant teddy bears, paint Havlow's name on it, let you tear its guts out, okay? Who the hell does he think he is? While Julie glowered back at the house, Bobby drove away from it. He's Walter Havlow, babe, and he's got to be himself until he dies, which is a worse punishment than anything you could do to him. A few minutes later, when they were out of Villa Park, Bobby drove into the lot at a Ralph's supermarket and tucked the Toyota into the parking space. He doused the headlights, switched off the wipers, but left the engine running so they could have heat. Only a few cars were in front of the market. Puddles as large as swimming pools reflected the store lights. Bobby said, What have we learned? That we loathe Walter Havlow. Yes, but what have we learned that's germane to the case? Is it just a coincidence that Frank's been using George Ferris's name and Ferris's family was slaughtered? I don't believe in coincidence, neither do I. But I still don't think Frank is a killer. Neither do I, though anything's possible. But what you said to Havlow was true. Surely Frank wouldn't kill Irene Ferris and everyone else in the house, then carry around fake ID that links him to them. Rain began to fall harder than before, drumming noisily on the Toyota. The heavy curtain of water blurred the supermarket. Bobby said, "You want to know what I think? I think Frank was using Ferris's name, and whoever was after him found out about it. Mr. Blue Light, you mean? The guy who supposedly can make a car fall apart around you and magically induce streetlights to blow out? Yeah, him, if he exists. Mr. Blue Light discovered Frank was using the Ferris name and went to that address hoping to find him. But Frank had never been there. It was just